Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now open session for some of the adjournments.
Good morning, be seated, please. This is the first case in our calendar, 99-291, Ohio State Attorney General Larry Montgomery versus John Doe's. Mr. Carney.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Stephen Carney for the Attorney General and Crime Victims Fund. If I may, I'd like to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal. This case is about the power of the state court to enforce state law. We ask this court to reverse or at least vacate the lower court opinion, because that opinion still threatens the rights of all Ohio creditors, public or private, children of child support, or victims of crime. And those other creditors are the key to understanding this case. Because if you ask at every step of the analysis, what should a regular creditor do here? And then, once you answer that question, why should the Crime Victims Fund be any different? Any normal creditor should have gone to state court to collect on the debts owed here, and the Crime Victims Fund did the right thing in going to the state court, and Judge Watson of the Common Pleas Court did the right thing in enjoining these inmates and making sure they would pay their just debts.
Mr. Carney, let me ask you the threshold question. As you know, the Sixth Circuit here has mooted the legal issue in this case for us, at least the issue that gave rise to this case. Why should we decide this case when it's mooted?
There are several reasons for that, Your Honor. First is that this court often hears and reviews and decides moot cases when there's a case of great public interest, and this case certainly is, or when a case is capable of repetition and evading review. And many of the court's cases in that line are cases like closed courtrooms or things that happen early in the trial or afterwards it's too late. And competing or allegedly competing preliminary injunctions or races to different courthouses are a classic example of things that later might never come up to this court for appeal. If you look, many of the cases quoted by the lower court are cases from the 1920s and 30s, and this case offers a great opportunity for this court to offer guidance and clarify how state courts can enforce state law. And more importantly, this particular order about theories of interference and when a state court can act threatens all creditors, at least in Franklin County, and it should seem as precedent throughout the state, because it threatens all creditors. Because although the court talks about who the parties were later in its opinion, much of its theory is logically based on this idea of interference with the federal court.
But the facts in this case are not likely to occur again, are they? This is a really unique fact situation, it seems to me.
Well, Your Honor, the facts in this case, in one way, are already repeating. Just last week, we received, unfortunately too late to file this with this court, but we'll ask permission as soon as argument's over to file. The court down in Cincinnati, the federal trial court, denied a motion to intervene from child support agencies in Cuyahoga County and Hamilton County. It told them, for people who are owed money from inmates who may receive money in the federal settlement, it told them, you can't intervene in this court. You can't come to federal court. Go use state law. Go somewhere else. So those people who owe child support are told, don't come to federal court. Well, the Court of Appeals in Ohio, in the state court, said, don't come here, you should have gone to federal court. Well, that creates a big gaping hole in the law. This isn't a case of overlapping jurisdiction. It creates federal jurisdiction over here saying, don't come here, state court saying, don't come here, and the children of child support and those mothers and agencies fall in the gap in that jurisdiction that the 10th District has created.
But didn't the Court of Appeals say don't come here because the federal court has already issued an order that specifically deals with the guardianship, deals with the attachment. And once that order lifted, didn't that remove the whole basis of this Court of Appeals decision? And this Court of Appeals decision was not based on the settlement. It was based on the order of the trial judge saying you can't attach this money. And that created a very different scenario. Why is that not?
For two reasons, Your Honor. First, we need to clear up a misunderstanding. We did not in any way attack any federal settlement fund. All we did is have a personal injunction against inmates. We attached inmate accounts, which everyone conceded was allowed. We didn't send some word to the federal court that says, hey, before you send out the checks, send a piece to us first. We didn't try to intercept money.
I understand that, but my thought was before it
sure as hell did. You did it through the back door. Didn't do it through the front door. If I write this, that's what I'm going to say.
And you can't come to state court to interfere with what the federal court has said. What the Court of Appeals in the federal system says, Rockmore, you can't do that, not part of the settlement, then why doesn't it go back to the status quo where the money flows to the inmate, goes into their account, and is attached to the regular state court proceeding?
Because, Your Honor, what we did and what the child support agencies are trying to do is not just wait for when the money lands, although that's the main part of it, but also tell the inmates not to preemptively try to move it around. And what the federal court order did when it said, go ahead, you can have assignments, is no different from if in a future case, a right to assign, rather than being a separate order 6 months later, is built into a settlement order.
That's over. They can't assign anymore. Federal court said, you can't do it. The trial court is bound by the Sixth Circuit, right?
Correct.
Okay. So now, you told me you have not gone to federal court to try to attach the money directly, correct?
Correct.
But isn't that what Cincinnati Parents said, right? You go to federal court and attach it directly, and the federal court said, no, you go back to state court and attach your account like every other credit.
Right. But the problem with that is that other orders, and we agree, this will not happen to the Crime Victims Fund regarding assignments. It will not happen regarding assignments as a particular type of order. But in future cases, every time there's a class action, there's a settlement order that a federal court has to approve. And it would not be that uncommon for that approved settlement to say, payments shall be sent to any of these asbestos claimants or whoever they designate. That would be an order that most private defendants, even public defendants, might not oppose in a lot of circumstances. And so there might be built into a settlement order, name your assignee. And it would still be appropriate, even if that's in an original order, whether it's a judgment or a settlement, for a federal court to do that, but then for a state court to say, okay, there are 1,000 asbestos claimants here, but one of them owes some money. And that claimant can't, in advance, say, you know what, don't send my award to me. Send it over here because I don't want to pay up this debt. And that happens all the time. If there's a squabble in one court about who owns a piece of property, and meanwhile that plaintiff is involved in a divorce or something, a divorce court can tell someone, wait a minute.
But you have tools to deal with that. You can, A, in settlement, the settlement negotiations don't allow that, or B, you can attack the individual that assigned it and the fraudulent conveyance.
Well, what we tried to do was the latter here. In one form of a fraudulent conveyance is to take your money and shift it over. Another form of a fraudulent conveyance is to preemptively transfer it by saying, just don't send the money to me. If I win the case, send it over there.
And you still have a state court remedy of fraudulent conveyance if you did that.
We do, but the Fraudulent Conveyance Act says as a remedy, you can enjoin a conveyance before it happens. Because otherwise, we have to say, if they send it out and the money leaves the jurisdiction, we have to say, well, you still owe us that money next time you make some money. And when you have people who are likely judgment-proof, the whole purpose of the Fraudulent Conveyance Act is to stop before there's a transfer. And what they were doing was they were transferring their right to get money, which is something people can transfer all the time under contract. They can say, if I win, just don't send it to me. And courts can enjoin that. We enjoin people all the time from trying to transfer away their money, even trying to transfer it away in advance.
I never even get that far in the case. And you ought to have a fair shot at me, I guess, because it seems to me you can talk about overlapping jurisdiction. I'd rather talk about original jurisdiction. The federal court has clear original jurisdiction in this action to operate.
This action that we've sued in.
The fund.
Correct.
The fund. Now, the court has jurisdiction over the fund, and on that basis, wouldn't we be violating if nothing else, the doctrine of comity, C-O-M-I-T-Y, between us and the federal system by trying to assume jurisdiction over something that we don't have any business in. It looks to me, with all due respect, like what the Attorney General is trying to do is do through the back door what she couldn't get done through the front door. And that's really what's happening.
Not at all, Your Honor. Because, again, we ask first, okay, if there would have been, if the child support agencies 2 years ago would have run to the Common Pleas Court and said, those guys are going to get some money, they owe us some, Judge Watson, will you enjoin them? Under the Court of Appeals theory of that would interfere, under the Court of Appeals theory, he would have had to tell them no. Whether they were at the settlement table or not, whether they were allegedly a party connected or not, their theory says this kind of order interferes. And we find it hard to see what kind of theory in the next case is going to say, why is an order less interfering? I'm being interfered with, whether it's you or you or you, it's still interference. And their interference theory would stop parties besides the Attorney General.
All right, let's put aside what you said and what the excellent points made by Justice Stratton about how we go through these kind of cases that many of us have handled. And let me ask you directly, what does John Doe, 1, 2, or 70, 49, owe to the Attorney General?
Each one of them owes a different amount.
Now, I'm not talking about amounts. What do they specifically owe? What debt?
They owe reimbursement to the Crime Victims Fund.
Okay.
And individualized debts. The way it works is,
I understand. Now, does the Attorney General have specific authority to bring an action on behalf of the Crime Victims Fund to recover?
Yes.
All right. So she has that direct authority to go against assets that are not otherwise controlled or governed by a court order in some other jurisdiction.
Correct.
Okay. Weren't these assets otherwise controlled in another jurisdiction, to wit the federal court?
No.
They created the fund.
No, because the fund is over here in the federal court. And we set an attachment against, in the cases where we already had a judgment, against inmate accounts. But in the case of several, there was no judgment yet, and we asked for a personal injunction. And if you look, all of the cases cited by the appeals court, all of the cases, Princess Lita and all of those, say you've got to look at whether an action is against a thing or a person. And the other side agrees these are both in personam actions going on here. And those cases all say you can never have a clash unless two courts try to touch the same piece of property. We didn't ask how the property gets doled out. If the federal court says, you know what, this guy wasn't beat up that bad, or he only had a broken jaw, that's only worth $50, whatever the federal court decides to give, we're not challenging that at all with the Crime Victims Fund. We're not saying, no, wait, give him less money. We're saying he gets $500, $1,000, whatever, and when he comes here, we're waiting.
Are you challenging the right of the federal court to say that each of these people who are entitled to money can transfer it to a third person?
Well,
that's what your suit is about.
Not this case, Your Honor. Even if he had the power to do that, and the Sixth Circuit said later that he didn't have jurisdiction, but even if he did, even if his order were proper for 1,000 inmates, it would be still proper for 70 defendants or 50 defendants or even one defendant to say, but not you. I mean, what if the settlement agreement were between any two parties and they wrote right into the settlement order, you have the express power to name where you want your money to go? And they said, wait a minute, not you. State court says, if once you win that battle, make sure you don't spend that money elsewhere. Just like a divorce court can tell someone, bring your money back from Switzerland. You're just enjoying the person. You're telling the person what to do. And those people are perfectly under our jurisdiction, and Judge Watson did the right thing, and this court should uphold his order and reverse the sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney. Mr. Morrow.
I'm giving all that yourself. It's moved.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Joshua Morrow, and I represent the House of Appellees, the Job of Defense. I am here to argue that Ohio Common Pleas Court does not have the power to grant injunction that interferes with the federal court's exclusive jurisdiction.
Let me see if I can understand exactly what the Sixth Circuit did. The Sixth Circuit, as I understood it, you can't add something that wasn't negotiated. You can't give them the power to do third-party advisor. Is that correct?
That is correct. They said that they do not have the power to alter a settlement agreement to give the John Doe defendants the right to assign.
Okay. Now, John Doe won yet $150 from the fund. What happens? Who writes the check and who sends the check where?
It comes out of the settlement fund from the federal district and goes to John Doe 1, who is presumably be in prison, and his money then would be garnished from the Attorney General.
So right now, John Doe 1 can't tell the fund to write it to my friend Joe.
There is no ability for John Doe to assign his money out.
And the fund writes a check to John Doe, sends it to the warden, if he's still incarcerated, or to the estate or whatever, and then state court takes over?
Correct. There is no controversy before this court. Because the Sixth Circuit vacated the federal order allowing third-party assignments, there is no controversy. Simply put, there's nothing for you to rule. The Attorney General claims that there's issue an advisory opinion. However, the Attorney General cannot reasonably show that the state will be affected by your respective ruling. No matter what this court holds, it will not affect the parties, either positively or negatively. The Attorney General concedes that there is no controversy, but the Attorney General argues that the court should spend its resources because the issue is one of great public interest and is capable of repetition yet evading review. But a closer analysis of these arguments reveals that these two documents are not for the court. The issue regarding whether the Common Pleas Court has the power to grant the injunction is simply of not great public interest. The Attorney General argues that the public is interested in the rights of crime victims and is interested in issues regarding Lucas Hill riots. But the issue before this court is not about the rights of crime victims and is not about Lucas Hill riots. The issue is purely a jurisdictional issue. And although legal scholars may be interested in this issue, it is not pertinent to one of great public interest. Likewise, the issue before the court is not likely to arise again. Because the Sixth Circuit's ruling to eviscerate the lower federal court's ability to grant third-party assignments, this issue will never be repeated in the state of Ohio. The issues arose because the district court granted highly unusual equitable relief. The federal court granted this relief because, and I quote, it was deeply troubled by the Attorney General's efforts to recapture the money that it agreed to pay to the inmates.
But the Sixth Circuit, of course, said, the Sixth Circuit seemed to disagree with that, the source of that troubling to the federal judge. I mean, the Sixth Circuit seemed to say, it's not your business.
I think what the Sixth Circuit ruled is they didn't have the ability to alter a settlement agreement. I'm sure that there was some dicta regarding that they probably should have altered it, but they didn't have the power to alter
right.
the settlement agreement. Two parties, being class members and the Attorney General of the state of Ohio, agreed.
The mootness issue, though, in terms of the mootness issue, what we have now is a 10th District decision that is grounded in a belief that there was a conflict between the jurisdiction of the trial court here in Columbus and the federal district court, and which no longer exists, but the decision of the 10th District would conflict with what we now know was maybe an error by the trial court, the federal district court.
I'm not sure if that's correct, mainly because the 10th District ruled that there was interference between the federal court order and the state court order.
Right.
The federal court granted the right to assign, the state court injunction took that right away.
Right.
There was clearly an inherent conflict between that, and that's what the 10th District states, that because the federal court had exclusive jurisdiction over the settlement fund, the state can't go ahead and get an injunction to prevent, effectively, the federal court from doing what it wants to do with the settlement fund.
As it stands today, can the state, since the 10th District decision says thou shalt not enjoin, and based on a now overruled decision by Judge Spiegel, are we in a somewhat of a quandary where that's the state of the facts now? We have the 10th District.
That's incorrect because And effectively, the Attorney General has sought an injunction in the last month or so that prohibited any assignments or prohibited any transfers. But since there's no right to assign, there's nothing preventing from the State Board of Commissioners from granting an injunction that prohibits any assignments.
The 10th District decision?
The 10th District decision does not affect that disability at all. The 10th District decision was only based upon there was a conflict between a federal court order.
Well, we know that we now know that, but what it is, it still sits there, huh?
It sits there preventing, you know, any other conflicts within the 10th District if anything would ever happen again. But since the Sixth Circuit's decision totally eviscerated the ability for a federal trial court to grant, you know, an order that prohibits or allows assignments, that it's likely never come up again.
Is this case distinguishable from United States versus Klein?
Yes, it is. That case was purely based on interim jurisdiction, and I agree with the Attorney General that this case is only in personal jurisdiction. The class member sued the Attorney General, the State of Ohio and officials for money damages, and the Attorney General sued John Doe's for money damages, so clearly they're both in personal. So, United States v. Klein, although there is a big bit in there that kind of gives guidance regarding this issue and whether there is comedy should be provided between federal courts and state courts. But no, it's
what's the status? What's the status of this case if we affirm?
This case, it doesn't matter. Either way, for the Attorney General seeking to recoup the money from the John Doe's, and this, no matter what your ruling is, they're going ahead and going back. I think that last week all the money, or all the summary judgments were denied, and I think the Attorney General is seeking the money, as far as I know.
So if we affirm the case, doesn't make any difference. If we reverse the case, doesn't really make any difference.
It does not matter to the parties, one way or the other.
Okay.
What happens?
Let me take it step by step. What if we vacate the orders of the Court of Appeals and the trial court and say the whole thing's moot? Does that make it any different?
It doesn't make any other difference except there's no precedent in this area, and since issues never likely to come up again, it doesn't matter.
So we're spending a half hour and much, much longer than that reading all these briefs for an exercise in futility.
Correct.
That's very comforting.
What's your response to Mr. Carney's suggestion that this case would get control or would have some bearing on the decision in Cincinnati, the federal court, the Southern District?
We are not arguing that the state court, the Attorney General should have brought her case to federal court. There is no question, there is no comedy to this obvious fact that would compel ancillary jurisdiction. Likewise, we'd like to make clear that we are not arguing that the state court lacks jurisdiction here to undermine the case. We are merely arguing that after the state lost the assignment issue before the federal court, it was not proper for the state to then go to a state court to get an order which was exactly contrary to it.
But that's the real debate, whether it truly was contrary.
That is true. That is the debate, but if you look at the language, it's clear that there is a conflict. One order positively allowed third-party assignments. One order prohibited third-party assignments. There's clearly a conflict. If you look at the language of the two orders, there's no question that there is a conflict between these two orders.
Well, but the argument is, though the federal court says generally allow, a state court could say, but you, inmate number 22, you have this debt and it's legitimate and therefore we won't allow you. You see that as an argument that doesn't hold any water?
Well, there would still be a conflict. You're saying that the class members, the group of X number of prisoners were allowed to make assignments. And even if there was just an order saying one John Doe, you know, that is a classmate, you can't transfer, you can't assign your money that you were getting from the settlement fund, money in general, money that they were getting from the settlement fund.
That's just a different reading of what the federal court did. Obviously, the two sides in this room take a different reading. The words, I don't quarrel, and I don't think they do quarrel with the words, but they say it was a general permission.
Well, yes, they allowed them to do it. They did not mandate to the prisoners that you have to sit and sign your money. You have to give your money to your sister or your brother-in-law. Mm-hmm. No, the federal court did not mandate it to the prisoners, whether they could assign or not. No, it was not a mandatory order. but still, there's inherent conflict. Obviously, the federal court's not going to mandate that someone has to give their award from a settlement to somebody else. Obviously, they're going to, if there was any question about it, they allow them to do that. And obviously, as we discussed the claim, there's no controversy regarding that because they're not allowed to sign out anyway.
Let me ask you an esoteric question. Doesn't really have anything to do with the merits, but I'm curious. Isn't this a case where we sought you out to represent these people?
Correct.
The court, we, the Supreme Court, did, asked these people to be represented by you.
Correct.
You spent 200 hours on it?
Probably a little more than that.
If they win, is there going to be any money left in the fund to pay you?
I don't think I'm getting paid today.
Thank you.
You're not? No, I'm dead serious.
No, I do this case pro bono. I'd be happy if my boss is here. And also, he would be happy if we got paid today also. But this case must stand for the proposition
that
the parties cannot use the Ohio State court system as an appellate court for the federal court system. If the Attorney General was not happy with the court order allowing assignment, she had one course of action she wished to challenge that. And that course of action was to appeal it to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. And that's exactly what she did, making this case moot. At the time of the Common Pleas Court's injunction, the federal case had not been dismissed. The settlement money had not been distributed to class members. Clearly, the federal court had not exhausted its jurisdiction over the settlement money. But still, the Attorney General sought a state court injunction that went beyond subrogation suit and attempted to dictate to the federal court how to administer the settlement fund. As the 10th District stated, the relief sought by the Attorney General through the preliminary injunction went beyond merely attempting to establish statutory right of subrogation. The injunction purported to assert control over the manner in which the proceeds of a settlement fund would be distributed. This case is on all fours with Donovan v. Dallas, which made it clear, the United States Supreme Court ruling, that made it clear that a state court does not have the power to enjoin parties from proceeding federal court. The issue is not an issue of full faith and credit, and it's not an issue of res judicata. The issue is whether the state court has the power, the jurisdiction, to interfere with the federal court system. It is clear that it does not. We would also like to make it clear that the federal court did not know of the state's request for an injunction when it ruled on November 24, 1997. Although the federal court was aware of the state's efforts to recapture the monies, the court did not know the Attorney General was seeking an injunction to prevent assignments. The state's request for injunctive relief was not made in its two complaints before the Common Pleas Court. The issue regarding injunction did not arise until many months after the federal court issued with brief and argued. There is also an issue regarding whether the Sixth Circuit stay of the Federal District Court order pretty much allowed the Common Pleas Court to grant the injunction. The Attorney General's reply brief argues that the injunction did not appear with the federal court order because the Sixth Circuit had stayed the federal court at the time of the injunction. The Attorney General argues that because there was a stay, the Common Pleas Court could ignore the federal court order. This is simply not correct. Although a stay of proceedings does prevent an order from being enforced, it does not make the prior order irrelevant. Contrary to the Attorney General's argument, the Sixth Circuit stay is not set aside or null the federal court order. The state merely stays the enforcement of the previous order. It is not making it or affected in any other manner. Because the Common Pleas Court should not have ignored the federal court, it did not have the power to grant a preliminary injunction. I request that you affirm the 10th District Court of Appeals. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Morrow. Mr. Carter, you've saved a minute and a half of your time.
Your Honors, if the court finds the case moot, it ought to at least vacate so that this opinion does not cause further confusion in the future. But it ought to reverse because counsel has conceded that both these cases are in persona, but Klein and all of those cases say you never have a conflict unless both are in rem. And those two, they never square. If there's not in two in rem cases, if two people aren't fighting over the same piece of dirt for the same trust, you can never have a conflict. You just have personal suits going back and forth. And when no case in two centuries has found a conflict, in two in persona cases, this court or the 10th District ought not be the first. Also, they have never fully explained, and the 10th District's reasoning doesn't explain what could another creditor have done at that point in time. Or what if an order next week between two parties settles and they write right into a settlement order that's affirmed by a court, and you can name any designee you want. That tells child support people or any creditor next week and next month and next year, well, sorry, try chasing down in Indiana, do your best. And instead of just doing what we normally do, which is say, don't assign away a right you have. Sure, everybody has the right to assign. A lot of times in a settlement agreement, if it doesn't say either way, that's considered a natural right. I can assign my mortgage, I can assign all sorts of things. But just because you have a right to do something as a baseline doesn't mean that when you're trying to exercise that right to fraudulently avoid a payment that you can't be stopped. We have to do reverse and affirm that the trial court here did the right thing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carney. The case is submitted. You'll be advised by opinion.